Hello, I'm Susan Reeves. The music of pianist, vocalist, and composer Andy Bay is described as mesmerizing, deep, intimate, and accessible. His career has spread over more than 60 years, starting as a child prodigy on the piano and performing on the Apollo stage and on TV with legendary figures such as Sarah Vaughan and Louis Jordan. He created a trio with his sisters Geraldine and Salome and performed in the U.S. and Europe as Andy and the Bay Sisters from 1956 to 66. Andy then worked in many diverse settings, from his famous collaborations with Gary Bartz and with Horace Silver, to performances with Max Roach, McCoy Tyner, and many others, and to musical theater appearances. In the last 10 years, he has created 4 CDs as a leader, including Ballads, Blues, and Bay in 1996, and the Grammy-nominated American Song in 2004. He'll be performing with his trio during the following Monk Festival at Duke University on October 18, 2007, with a program entitled Carmen Sings Monk, A New Interpretation. I spoke with him recently from New York. I'm so delighted to get to talk with you about your music, Mr. Bay.
Thank you for having me.
Growing up in the 40s in Newark, New Jersey, that was such an exciting time musically, a transition time from swing to bebop, and certainly New York was the scene. What was the Bay household like in those young years, the musical influences that you had?
Wow, there was many. Definitely the church and the blues. I mean, I didn't do a lot of singing in church, but I grew up around so many storefront churches. I mean, the Sanctified Holy Roller Church, you know, the Baptist. And I had aunts who were church members and things, because I came from a pretty big family with 9 kids. So there was always music. There was always a piano in the house. My father played piano, and my mother played piano by ear. But my father, he wasn't a professional musician, but he studied music. He played and sang, and he could read. But I actually started emulating my sister Salome, who'd had some lessons as a kid, and I started just banging on the piano, playing by ear, before I was 2 years old. One thing led to another. You hear the radio. I was captivated by Louis Jordan in the Timpani Five when I was a kid, because he had a couple of hits called Caledonia and a lot of those things. And he did some duets with Ella Fitzgerald. I remember Stone Cold Dead in the Market. We heard a lot of her stuff, like Lady Be Good and How High the Moon, the early recordings, Sarah, and lots of blues. Wynonie Harris and Eddie Cleanhead Vincent and gospel singers like Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Mahalia Jackson, and people in the neighborhood had extraordinary talent. We used to hear a lot of the blues artists coming through singing in the streets, like during the early 40s. I was born in 39, so I grew up, like you say, in the 40s, so I heard a lot of the authentic blues and the ballads. Sarah Vaughan was born and raised in Newark, so I heard a lot of her records. And little Jimmy Scott spent some time in Newark. You know, he's from Cleveland. I grew up listening to him when I was a kid, because he used to come through and play this club called Lloyd's Manor, along with Ruth Brown and Dinah Washington. They used to play in Newark during one-nighters. We had a lot of little small ballrooms and clubs. It was really a healthy period for live music. You could hear live music for little or nothing. I mean, I remember going to Birdland when I was 17 years old, the one on 52nd Street, and seeing 3 acts for $1.50. You know, you see Lester Young and Dinah Washington and the Mitchell Ruff duo, which was fantastic music. And you can sit there in the bleachers, because I didn't drink, so I used to sit in the bleachers and stay as long as I wanted for $1.50. The music was very accessible. There were times when I first started singing with my sisters, we used to be like the opening act for maybe, say, if Count Basie and Joe Williams came to the like a hall called the Wideway Hall in Newark. And we had just started. I was a child prodigy, but, you know, at one point I was singing with my sisters, and we eventually broke up. I'll never forget, we were at the Wideway Hall or the Terrace Ballroom, 2 of the big dance halls in Newark. And Count Basie's band was there for one night with Joe Williams. And it was just amazing to see that. I mean, you sure you listen to records, but when you see people dancing to the band, and it was so swinging. Music was basically dance music. I mean, even though it was listenable, if you wanted to go to stand at the front of the foot of the stage and catch Dinah Washington singing, you could listen, but then you can dance.
You talked about the big influences, all of the music you talked about with gospel and blues. Were your parents originally from New York, or had they moved from the South?
They were from North Carolina, I think. I think my father was from, he spent some time in Georgia, but my mother was from Georgia.
Uh-huh.
And they came up here, they came up north when they were like teenagers. You know, they met each other up north, actually.
Well, I find that fascinating because, of course, as with this festival with Monk, the interesting relationship here is the great migration that happened from the south to the north had been in progress for a while. Obviously, your parents must have been part of that. And, of course, Monk came to Manhattan from North Carolina at age 5 in 22, and Max Roach was born in the mountains of North Carolina, and his family moved to Brooklyn when he was 4 years old in, I guess that was 1928. A lot of people came from the south to that area.
My mother was born in 1904.
Okay.
And my father was born in 1903.
Yeah. But all of that great migration certainly would have meant that there was an awful lot of the southern influences in the New York and Newark area. Have you ever thought of the music that you learned then and were exposed to and then eventually performed as being from a southern influence?
Well, it's definitely a southern influence. A lot of my aunts were church people on my mother's side. My mother wasn't much of a church person, to be honest, but she was the most spiritual person I ever knew. The music was all around, especially the gospel music. They were storefront churches. I did some singing in church, but not like somebody like Aretha Franklin, whose father was a Baptist minister.
Mm-hmm.
My father actually was involved in Islam in the 40s. I mean, Orthodox Islam. He became a Sunni Muslim, you know, from Moorish American, because there were a lot of Moorish American that was a religious organization at the time. And then he got involved in Orthodox Islam. I did some singing in the church, because I used to do church functions. And my family had a lot of gospel singers as friends. So I've heard the music. I used to go to the Holy Roller churches all the time. I used to go because it was a church right across the street from us that I used to attend, because they used to have church functions. During the summer months, they would have barbecue and they would have tents. So I saw a lot of that every year. And then the blues singers. Then I was exposed to singing in nightclubs. And once I started singing and playing boogie-woogie, because I got involved in boogie-woogie, you know, as a kid. You know, because I was like a child prodigy.
Mm-hmm.
I could have went to California when I was 6 years old, but I got the whooping cough, what they call, you know, which was like walking pneumonia. I had to go to the hospital and for about 2 or 3 months. But at that time, it seemed like 2 or 3 years.
I'll bet.
Because I had sisters that saw Charlie Parker at Birdland. Jazz was the popular music. You could hear jazz music on WNEW, which was an AM station. It wasn't FM. You would hear Ella Fitzgerald, you would hear Sarah, you would hear Dinah Washington. Of course, they had the race thing going on. You stayed in your corner of the world, which was cool for me because I grew up listening to the music that I love, you know, like Ruth Brown and all the blues singers like the doo-wop groups and all of that, which came later on in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Nat King Cole was my hero. I saw him live when I was like 11 years old at a place called the Opera House. And I never forgot that. We were performing. It was Nat Phipps' band, was a local band in Newark that my sister sang with, Salome. Then I thought I was going to sing, but I didn't. But I got a chance to see Nat King Cole and meet him. And I was like 11, and he was about 6 feet tall, but he looked like he was about 7 feet. But I never forgot that. It was just a tremendous experience that stayed with me all of these 60 years. People that have touched me, you know, like I saw Billie Holiday perform on television live in 1950 when she was still in her prime, when the voice was maturing and it didn't deteriorate. Not that that was bad in any way. You know, you can't even explain when somebody mesmerizes you in that way when you see them actually singing live, not filmed or anything, but it was a show that I was on, Spotlight on Harlem. And I saw Sarah Vaughan on the same show, who I loved, and I was on the show when Dinah Washington was on it. So I had a chance to experience these people up close. I got to know Sarah quite well, and Carmen. Yeah, I got a chance to really know them intimately, in a sense.
Did you ever study classical music?
I studied in 1970. I decided I wanted to learn more about voice projection and all that stuff. So I had to really understand where the head voice and the break and the head and chest mix it's funny when you, after you stop studying, you begin to piece things together and figure out things, which you have to figure it out. Not saying I got it, because I'm still working on things. I studied with different teachers. Teachers tried to convince me that I was a tenor because I had all that extension, that range. Mm-hmm. Finally met one that understood where my voice was. He said, the color of your voice is dark. He said, you have a very high extension, but you're not a tenor. I said, thank God. I had some coaching years ago, so I really knew how to, you instinctively cover the sound when when your voice is dark. I mean, I could never sing open a high B flats or whatever, like a tenor, and without closing it, like a lyric tenor. Because I always had a lot of range, you know, I had good falsetto, but I'm learning how to mix the sounds together now where I can, it sounds more like tenor because I'm not really using the actual belt, even though I'm still using it from time to time, but I've learned how to coast and learn how to control things a little more. And I had some classical training because I sang a little opera. I sang opera in school. We did La Boheme, but I was just a teenager then. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but they wanted me in.
Did you study piano classically with the harmonies?
I studied piano classically for about a year, but I'm basically self-taught. But I studied with two piano teachers by the name of Sanford Gold and Tony Aless. Tony Aless actually played with Charlie Parker, I think, on some of those big band records. Somebody introduced me to them. But I couldn't continue to, I couldn't afford it, but he had me on little Bach inventions, which I couldn't play too well. I had Clemente Sonatinas, and I would have went into the Chopin Etudes, but that's when the money started going. But I've been working on stuff anyway, because I'm into classical music. I love Bartok. So I'm in the 12-tone rows and all kind of 20th century later classical music. I love Stravinsky and Bartok and Alban Berg and Schoenberg. And, of course, I like Debussy and Ravel and all those people.
So all of that comes out in your music.
Oh, yeah, and I'm still working on stuff. Somebody taught me how to work with 12-tone rows in terms of writing out a scale without repeating any of the notes. And when you're improvising from a pianistic standpoint, you can play those against any chord sequence because they're all the notes relate to the chords anyway. If you got a 4-bar phrase, if you play a 12-tone row over that, it still works. It stops you from playing a lot of unnecessary harmonic. Not that playing harmonic sequences is bad, but you know, it just opens up a new avenue for you.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I've always been into skips and intervals. You know, I have a kind of an odd sense of how I hear intervals, but it has helped me to hear, because I got perfect pitch, and that helps me to hear polytonal. I mean, I can hear a polytonal thing. I can sing in one key and then play in another key. Just kidding, Lack. I used to do that. My sister used to say, "Would you get in tune, please?" I like doing that when I'm, let's say if I'm improvising with a bass and drum, with a scat thing or whatever, if I'm doing Donna Lee or Cheryl, any of the bebop tunes, I might like to go into other keys because it really helps me to explore. So I do that when I play piano, which I'm playing more now. I'm practicing a lot because I really want to play more piano because I never stopped playing. But now I'm really, really focusing on it a little more because it's something that I really want to do. I like this new CD in a sense, even though the tapes are like 10 years old, but it's with some piano that I played with Peter Washington and Kenny Washington. And one of the tunes is on the CD, If I Should Lose You. There were some nice things going on. It makes me want to explore even more, but you really have to practice. I'm still working on the voice and working on my compositions because I write. So it's a lot of work. You know, even at almost 68 years old, I'm glad that I feel somewhat inspired. Sometimes I feel it's just begun, but I really hopped up about exploring improvisation.
The elements of angularity and intervals you mentioned in your playing, do you feel that they come at all from Monk?
Monk is somebody who I love so much and who I listen to, but Monk is a world within himself. I mean, yeah, you can pick up little things, and if you play anything that's idiosyncratic, people might say Monk. And I'm sure I'm influenced by him, but I never self-consciously try to play like him. But maybe I have in some ways from the few little things I picked up, but I'm hearing differently in a sense. Like they say Herbie Nichols sounds like Monk, but I think if you listen, you'll hear that they're from that same lineage in some ways. If you try to play his compositions, you're going to sound somewhat like Monk. Like I'm going to play one or two tunes because it's basically like a lot of the lyrics that Carmen sings. since I do play piano, I'm going to play a tune or two, maybe. I've been working on Trinkle Tinkle, which is very difficult, and I've been working on 4-1, and even there's one called Arano. Right. But I've been playing, you know, I got a fake book on Monk, so I've been reading slowly through a lot of his stuff. Yeah, you can play the melody, but a lot of those little subtle things that you pick, you can't copy that. And even if you get it, you don't get it. Because Monk's sound, you know, the way he touched the piano, it was totally different from anybody that you would ever even think of. Basically, he comes from the Stride family. He loved James P. Johnson, and he loved all those cats, Willie the Lion, Duke Ellington. People say Monk comes from Duke, which he does. Even Horace Silver comes from Monk, but he comes from Monk and Bud. And even Bud's got some Monk in him. But Monk was like a mind. Nobody had a mind like that. He could take stuff and break it down to such the bare bones of, not of this planet. He had classical training a little bit, but he developed his own thing. You can't learn that in school. They don't teach that. Yeah, you got the legit players. All praises to Bill Evans, and who I dig, and I dig. Of course, Hank Jones was a major influence on me. I love Bud, and I love so many people. It's a lot of things in me that I can't really explain, you know, from a music standpoint. One minute I might listen to some R&B, and I might be listening to Johnny Mathis, because I think Johnny Mathis is incredible in terms of somebody who's got skill and the vocal skill, just sound and how he utilizes his breath control. He's incredible, and I wouldn't care if he sang bop or slop, but I just appreciate the intelligence in how he sings. And then I might listen to a Sonny Rollins. I might get into a Indian music. This Indian singer from India, Shubha Lakshmi, who I love. She sings stuff that's unheard of.
Did you ever get a chance to meet Monk?
Oh, yeah, I met Monk.
What was that like?
It was an incredible experience. Because he don't say much. How I met him, actually, when we got to Boston, which is uncanny, Monk was playing at Storyville that the night before we were supposed to open. Because I was supposed to open opposite Max Roach and his group. So it would have been Max Roach's quintet without a piano. Mm-hmm. And then me and my sisters. Max and his bass player played for us. I went out that night to see Monk's closing. And who he had playing with him was Scott LaFaro and Paul Motion, along with the tenor player, Charlie Rouse. And I met Scott LaFaro. It was in 1960. And Monk stayed over for our sound check because he knew, of course, he knows Max. And he came to our sound check. Because I'll never forget, he commented on my sisters came in wearing some slacks with a little bandanas on their heads, just relaxing to do the sound check. And Monk was saying how hip that was. You should wear that for the gig.
Were there any other opportunities to be with him or talk with him?
Every time I would go see him, he would always acknowledge me. Because I would go to see him at the Village Gate in New York, or either at Birdland or the Village Vanguard, or either at the Five Spot, you know, the new Five Spot, not the other one, because they had changed after a while. But he would come in come in his time anyway, and sit right at the piano and start playing. You know, the guys would be there. But sometimes he would start solo. But he said he liked my playing. Charlie Mingus liked my playing. You know, Sonny Rollins liked my playing. I played with them both. I did gigs with them on piano.
I'm so glad to hear that you're going to be doing more piano, because you are a fabulous pianist and you have much to let us hear from the piano side. Playing the piano and accompanying yourself as opposed to having someone else play for you, it would seem to me there'd be so much more ability for the connection with the lyric and the emotion if you're controlling what the piano is doing at the same time. And of course you do both. You accompany yourself on some concerts and CDs, and others you're doing it all.
I'll be doing more of all of it, because I'm playing more. I mean, I work with a very fine guitarist because of some of the songs that I've recorded with guitar. But I'm kind of out of that. I just want to play for myself like I first started doing. All I used to work with was a bass and a drum, or mm-hmm. do a solo gig. Because I've always played for myself. And I would stand up maybe if I wanted to scat something, I would scat with just the bass and drum without piano, which I've done on many occasions, which I still do. Playing for myself, I can stay out of my own way, and I can control the tempo. I can control the harmonic flow. They don't have to be the same thing. If somebody's playing for you, they have a tendency to know what to expect, especially if it's arranged a certain way. Not saying that it can't be fun, but it's nothing like playing for yourself and exploring and getting a chance to blow and improvise. And I wasn't doing enough of that. I was doing some of it, but I begin not to stretch enough. And I want to stretch more like I used to do back in the old days, you know, where it was no limit on, where you didn't feel restricted in a studio or a concert. But if you're playing with somebody that you can feel, I mean, if you're working with somebody like a Kenny Washington and a Peter Washington, like on these tapes that are coming out, the tapes are over 10 years old, but the spirit has a timeless feel to it where it doesn't sound old. Because I was kind of like, well, they're kind of old. You know, sure, you do things then that you probably would want to do differently. But even that's cool. I mean, I can live with that. Because it was at the moment, it was for that time.
Yes. You mentioned about the slow tempos. I think of you as the king of glacial tempos. Shirley Horn, of course, had that ability.
Yeah. I knew her back in 1960.
Uh-huh.
When I first heard her album, Ashes and Embers, or Embers and Ashes, whatever. And I've always loved Shirley, you know, ever since the time that she used to open up for Miles at the Vanguard. So she was a hero. Of course, Nat was my idol because of the taste and his ability to just sing so simply and play with such finesse. He was the one. I mean, with all due respect to anybody else, mm-hmm. any tempo, just effortless flow with him playing and singing and just standing up singing. To me, you know, he had a way of just doing it with such simplicity, but with such a lot of soul and a lot of swing. It was so subtle. He was a swinger without saying, look, I'm swinging.
Mm-hmm.
Beating you over the head. I mean, that was my hero for that, for anything, for just singing any song. I don't care if the song was a dud. He always sang with care. He took the most mundane, bad, horrible tune and make it work for me. And he made me like Ramblin' Rose.
The program that you're going to be doing at the following Monk Festival, entitled Carmen Sings Monk, A Reinterpretation, did you create this program specifically for the festival?
I think it was the producer's idea, because she got in touch with my record producer, Herb Jordan, and said they wanted to do a tribute to Monk. But it wasn't my idea. Of course, I got the CD with Carmen singing Monk. It really is not easy. I mean, even though I've been loving Monk, but I've never sang his songs with lyrics, because John Hendricks wrote some of the lyrics and some of the other composers wrote the lyrics as well. But it was Carmen's record that I'm really drawing from. But I'm sort of doing my own thing. I'm not really overarranging it, because Monk's music doesn't need it, but I'm just writing some intros and trying to get a little concept going to take off from where she left off, because
mm-hmm.
I'll be playing piano for myself.
Yes.
It'll be quite interesting. I'm looking forward to doing it, but I've been working hard on it. It's no fly-by-night thing. And I probably won't know all the lyrics perfectly, because I'm still trying to, well, I'll keep something on the piano to guide me with the lyric and the music, so I'll be able to synchronize rhythmically what I'm doing in case I get carried away trying to play a harmonic thing and lose myself with the lyric. That's why I always keep books of lyrics with me. Even if I'm singing a song for a million years, you never know. There are songs I know better than others. I really want to bring the meaning of the lyric to the music. But you got to really investigate his melodies, because they're very subtle. Even the harmonic shapes that he's playing on piano, I might have to change it around to fit the breathing flow of my voice to fit the melody with the lyric.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one thing to play it, but another thing to sing it. So you have to think a little differently, but not to take away melodically from what he's talking about.
The lyricists included, as you mentioned, John Hendricks, Mike Farrow, Sally Swisher, Abby...
She wrote the lyrics to Blue Mom.
Right, Abby Lincoln, and, of course, Bernie Hannigan's Round Midnight. Is there a favorite lyric in there to interpret?
Actually, I'm singing Babs Gonzalez's version, and then I'm singing John Hendricks's. I'm going to do two sets of lyrics. Believe it or not, I did a funk version of Round Midnight, recorded it. It's kind of us with a beat, with a high, really strong power voice, but I'm really singing it more like in a melodic thing, in a lower key.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually started out singing Babs Gonzalez, who wrote some fantastic lyrics that Betty Carter used to sing. And those are the lyrics I recorded. Because I used to sing the other one, It Begins to Tell, around midnight. But I'm going to sing John Hendricks' lyrics for the second time around after I finish the Babs Gonzalez lyrics, and I'm going to start with the verse of John Hendricks. But it's going to be interesting because I might, I'm working on it.
It's a challenge.
It really is a challenge.
And you mentioned that you were acquainted with Carmen.
Oh, yeah. I knew Carmen. We met Carmen in Europe. Actually, me and my sisters worked opposite Carmen at a place in New Jersey called the Dunes. It was like a little summer resort, and she had Bob Crenshaw and I think a piano player named Bill Rubenstein playing with her. And we kind of opened up for her, and we became, we sort of became friends. We were like, me and my sisters, we gave Carmen not a run for her money, but we were entertainers. And I think Carmen was in a, Carmen's very serious. I love Carmen, always loved her. Even the dark Carmen. Carmen can be inconsistent in her way in terms of even musically, but it's always she's singing herself. If you see her, she could be sweet and she could be rough and she could be a little of both. She always carried her thing with her, no matter where. When she was totally right, there was nobody like her. I mean, she was on the level of Ella, Sarah, Betty, or anybody else you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And even more so... I mean, with all of due respect for all of them, I loved, But Carmen was a unique person. I got to know her quite well. Anyway, we met her during that period, and then we met her in Europe. We were in Europe at the time, and she came through, and she stopped at the Blue Note, where Oscar Pettiford was hanging out with Kenny Clarke and her Bud Powell, whoever that bass player was, and actually... There was a set where Bud and Oscar Pettiford and Kenny Clarke played, and Carmen got up and sang, which was extraordinary for me, to hear that. And then sometimes she'd be in a mood where, she could be, but that was, we just let her be. I would go see her from the time that, when she got sick and one of her last performances at the Blue Note. And even the last two records, she was singing... even good, almost childlike. I had seen her in Europe when her breath was, she used to have to blow on something to keep her breath together because she was having problems with emphysema.
Yes.
But I hung out with her. She got up and sang with Javon, the Brazilian singer, and this was in the North Sea Jazz Festival back in 88.
You mentioned 88. That was, of course, the year that Carmen Sings Monk came out.
And I remember when she actually recorded it because I knew her manager, Larry Clothier. Because he used to work with Sarah as well. And he was in Europe. They were all in Europe at the time, at the North Sea Jazz Festival. Because she would go through her thing, she was going through some physical ailments. But then, she was so strong, boy, and even though the voice got darker, she could be so tender. She really could make you cry sometimes. Especially if you knew her. You knew that other side of her. But she didn't try to put on a show. If she was pissed, she would let you know.
The real thing.
Yeah, she was the real deal. I used to love to hear her play and sing, because she even sounded a little bit like Monk in her playing. She would play some chords that might not fit, but you would normally fit in the so-called correct harmonic sense. But she had a way of playing. I mean, because I used to see her on TV when she was actually playing more. I just wish she would have played more. But she got involved in standing up. I wish Sarah would have played more for herself, because Sarah could really play very well. Dinah Washington could play. I'd never heard Dinah play. They all could play some piano. Abby Lincoln is a pretty good pianist. She knows some piano,
Well, you're certainly in the category of singers and pianists from whom we would love to hear more piano. It sounds as if that's going to happen here in Durham real soon. Can you tell us about the band that's coming down for the festival?
I'm going to use two young guys. The bass player's name is Dezron Douglas, who grew up in Hartford, part of the Jackie McLean stable. A lot of the young musicians that come out of there. And he works with Kenny Garrett. They both work with Cyrus Chestnut. And I knew Neil Smith, the drummer. I knew him when he was working with Cyrus like 11 years ago, but he said he's playing with all kinds of people. I did a gig with him in Estonia just this early part of this year for So they have a lot of fire, you know. Mm-hmm. They've been rehearsing with me with some of my original music, which I hope to use them on. You know, but they've been busy and doing stuff. Finally heard from them, so they call me from time to time when they're not too busy.
Well, speaking of which, I can't let you go without hearing, you've mentioned several times through the interview, but I wanted to find out your future projects. You're mentioning about this CD and your composing. Please tell us more about that.
Yeah, I intend to do more of my own songs, and I intend to do a lot more playing, because I've been writing since the 70s. My music has somewhat of a metaphysical thing, but it's not really, it's more about the music than just the metaphysics, and just me talking about spirituality. One complements the other as far as I'm concerned, but I'm not trying to beat people over the head, because it's always about the music and the concept of the music. I want to really incorporate more improvisation from a pianistic standpoint and from a vocal standpoint, but just to be able to have the taste to be able to know when less is more and to make the concept happen. But that takes time. That takes working with cats, which I used to get frustrated because it wasn't enough time. You know, you don't have a band. Sometimes work wasn't as plentiful. You know, but I don't really worry about that much, because I think the main thing is the spirit has to come through. The spirit of anything you do, whether it's minimal or quantity or whatever, the main thing is the quality of whatever it is you do and try to make it mean something. I'd rather work less and do something that leaves a mark. I'm not going to get myself all worried about trying to please the audience or please the people. It's a matter of, you know, you communicate something. It's more than just to entertain. It's not about entertaining to me. If communication is entertainment, then I'm an entertainer. But there's a big difference as far as I'm concerned. Entertainment is always trying to give the people what they want, but communication is something deeper, because you're expressing something beyond yourself, hopefully. That's what you strive for. You're trying to get past your physical self about trying to control stuff other than letting something flow through you, in terms of not being afraid to take a chance. But sometimes entertainment, you're just trying to plan something to make something work so the audience will be, you're trying to get them to respond. I mean, with communication, you're just putting something out there from you, from yourself, beyond yourself, hopefully, deeper on a spiritual level more than a conscious thing of trying to say, well, look, I'm going to do this to see how this works.
And you mentioned about this CD from 10 years ago recordings. Is there a title to it and a release date?
It's called It Ain't Necessarily So.
Should we be looking for it in the record stores?
Yeah, I think it's the 30th of October.
Wonderful, which is just after your birthday and just after you've been here.
It'll come out after my 68th birthday.
Wow, what a great present. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this afternoon, and we just can't wait to hear you in person and all these things we've been talking about to get to experience your singing and your playing in October.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
We look forward to seeing you soon, and hope you have a wonderful rest of your night.
You too, and stay well.
Thank you.
Bye.